It's already switched on, is it?
Yes.
It's on.
Yes, yes.
The theme for the afternoon talk is pleasure, sex, and happiness. Can't hear. But it's close as it'll, without eating it. Hello, can you hear now? Thumbs are up. So, the theme for, still here? The theme for the afternoon talk. You have to turn up a little bit more.
I just did.
Oh, you did, okay. All right. So the theme for the afternoon talk is pleasure, sex and happiness. Concentration of the talk will be on the happiness, which might be a bit disappointing, but anyway. So we'll take the first two areas and then the third. So I'm reminded of a statement of the Buddha here. He was asked, what will destroy this world? This is 2,600 years ago when he lived. And his response was it, the desire and the pursuit of pleasure for oneself. That was the response. And when we look at our human condition, we take notice of the movements of our inner life. Not unusual, it's extraordinarily common, it is an epidemic in which there is the formation of the desire, there is the self which goes with it, and the self says, I want. And this conditioning, because our attention so often has been bought, this conditioning is so strong with us that the movement of the desire, that is wanting, which is problematic, can go through to any of the five senses. That means to our eyes, what I want to see and get, what I want to hear and have, what I want to smell and keep, what I want to taste, and that which I want to touch. She, he, this or that in the fields of comfort. But also the very wanting itself, with the pressure and the desire that goes with it, can also turn its attention to the past, turn its attention to the future, and we begin to recognize the impact and the influence that wanting has on the, not only on our life, but on the lives of others, and also on our environment, our diminishing resources. So this movement of the force of desire essentially or primarily goes in these directions of through the senses, to the past, to the future, and of course to the mind itself. I want my mind or my heart to be like this, and all the pressure and the wanting, why am I like this? I want to be like that. So between the five senses, past, future, and the condition of the mind, these are where the pleasures, the pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of what I want takes the priority. And it's a task, it's an adventure and an exploration for women and men on the earth, young and old, to look into this wanting. And we might ask ourselves, and it's an important question, when I really want something, I might say to myself and to others, I really got what I want through my senses, through pleasure, through sex, through whatever. I really got what I want, and it made me so happy. I was really happy to get what I want. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if this actually is happiness. Could it be that it's a relief? Understand the word relief? It is a relief from the wanting. I wanted it, something so much, and I got it, and that has then put an end to the wanting for the time being. Any of you have smoked? Any of you have had an addiction to drugs, to alcohol, some other substance or whatever, will know there is a wanting, and one wants to get craving, needing, pursuing, wanting so much. And once one's got the relief from the wanting, one feels better, temporarily. And could it be that a lot of wanting, desire, craving, which is consuming the world's resources and actually consuming our life correspondingly, could we explore ourselves here just enough to see whether this wanting is actually, it's the relief from it that we're really after, and therefore an opportunity to be in another way. Time to time, I mentioned my precious daughter, Nashona. She told me something a little interesting. So, she's a woman in her, God, how old is she? Born in 1981, so she's 38, striking and beautiful, and men wander around her like bees around the flower, some of them. Anyway. And so she met a guy, surprise, surprise, and the guy took her out for an evening meal, and she found out, actually through the meal mostly, that he was rich, rather rich, dealing in currencies and importing, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So they went to a restaurant to have their meal. And at the end of the meal, the waiter came and gave the bill to him. And what surprised her with the meal, that there was the menu there, quite a large menu, and there, that there was no price on the menu. And she said to him, "But had a nice meal, but there's no price." She said, "It's not one of those restaurants where you have a price beside the meal." So she was kind of naturally curious, and she said to him, "I want to see the bill." He said, No, it's just money. I really want to, it was the first date. "I really want to see the bill." He said, "Well, if you insist," and he handed it over. It was for £250, which is around 1,250 shekels for a meal. And he said, "Oh, there's another level above this kind of restaurant. I don't live in this world, I just like my, coffee and a latte and a croissant, if I can afford it." Anyway, he said, "In the better restaurants, there is no menu. The chef walks over to your table and said, 'Madam, sir, what would you like to eat tonight?'" I have a school in India. We have 600 children in our school. That kind of money would pay for that meal, would pay for the education for a full year of four of our children. A full year's education in Bodh Gaya, in India, for the cost of a meal for two people. This is the madness of the world that we are living in. So we want to really explore this relationship to wanting, dependency on results about air, anything whatsoever. And sometimes, in all of that, we need to have the quiet inner authority with ourselves just to check in, because so much of the wanting is so often is there is a gap inside of myself, whatever, I don't have enough money, surprise, surprise, comes to mind with many people. I don't have enough. And what's noticeable, even for those who we look at, who we think have enough, feel they don't have enough because they've only got 1 million shekels or 5 million shekels, and they don't have enough because somebody's got 10 million. And this insidious, unhappy relationship to life, born of so much comparing, in which human beings, in the thirst for pleasure, we keep comparing what we have with what others have. How can there be happiness in that? It's just, as I point out, a temporary relief from the pleasure, from the wanting. Therefore, it's to find and dig a little deeper. One of the primary forms of wanting, you have to watch this, but there, and it doesn't make too much difference with regard to this, it's in the area of relationship. If I had a shekel for every conversation I've had in relationships on retreat. So in the area of relationship, the wanting sparks something, and there is the possibility or the hope or the wish or whatever towards the other. And one, actually here in Israel a few years ago, my beloved women friends, she said to me, "Christopher, inside of me, I have this idea." She's very, some people here will know her, so I'm not going to mention names here, but she's very intelligent and bright and beautiful and enchanting. And she said, "The man inside of me that I want to meet," she said, "I can't find." And I said, "Honestly, that man you have inside of you, who's the man you want to meet, honestly, he doesn't exist." So in other words, there can be the image and the picture of who one wants to meet, this is in relationship, and we can spend a lot of time, and some people a lot of money, on the online world, of looking for that image inside and the external to fit the image. Good luck. Oh, risky business, trying to fuse the world of the image and the actuality together. And one of my beloved exes, ex-past, from Sweden, she won't mind me mentioning because she knows it, Nina. She, after the relationship ended, then we made the transition, which was very sweet, to really good friendship. This was a couple of decades or so ago. She said to me, "Christopher, I'm looking around and I realize there are four kinds of men in this world." So, actually, I'm a man, I'm curious about these four kinds. So one kind of man in the world, he just wants to get married and have a couple of kids and settle down and live, just be a married man with a wife, a couple of kids, and life goes by, and that's all he wants from life. He said, "This kind of man doesn't interest me." Then she said, "There's a second kind of man. He knows what he wants, and he's really going for it, making money. He wants, and he's got or getting the big house, and with the double garage, and he wants 2.2 children, and he wants a beautiful woman to complete the whole picture story." And she said, "I'm just not interested in these guys who just think about getting rich. I'm not interested in that." One woman said to me, she said, the man I want to marry is the man who turns left when he gets on an aeroplane. Instead of, like, most of us here, probably in the economy class, we turn right. She said, I want to marry a man who turns left. You know, everybody has their own cup of tea and these things, etc. She said, the third kind of man, this is a warning to the men in the hall here, the third kind of man is the man who's, unlike the second kind, the moneymaker, he's in touch with his feelings, he goes on Tovana meditation retreats or some other retreat there, he shares his heart with you, he's kind and he's thoughtful and he meditates every morning and evening. And he eats salad and hummus every day, and etc. Yeah. But she said, I want a man. What happened to the man? Nice and sweet and kind, but where's the man? So then she said, then there's the fourth kind of man. Hopefully it'll fit in the category here. And the fourth kind of man, yes, he's working on himself, he's looking at his heart, he's learning to articulate what he feels, he's sharing, he's open, and he's got vision, and he's got action, and he's dedicated, he's committed to this world. And then she said at the end, the problem is, Christopher, all these men, the women have taken, they've all gone. I hope it's not true, but anyway, who am I to say? So sometimes, to come to the point here, how easily life and days and weeks and months can go by and we have a preoccupation with a particular object, and this might be called relationship, yeah. It could be called money or whatever it is. And the human being exploring himself and herself, how much is the value of worth as a human being actually dependent on the other? That's the question. How much is one's humanity and one's sense of being, to know that and experience that well and deeply, so that, yes, one, we can be in a relationship. Yes, we can love our solitude and our aloneness. And that movement between the two. And I hear, but I've here on this retreat, on the last retreat, on the retreats in other countries, lots of important questioning and conversations around relationship and specifically around sexuality. A general view is two things. One is, on the level with religion, apart from, I must say, some strands in the Hindu tradition, religion has not been comfortable in sharing and talking and exploring and encouraging sexuality in the romantic life. It's tended to keep a distance from it there, which is unfortunate. I must say, to its great credit, Hindu tradition has a tradition of exploring the erotic. It has not in all sections, obviously, it has a tradition of the importance of the romantic element in the human being. No more clear and obvious than the stories, the teachings, the plays and the poems and the great insights, Rama and Sita. They're in a relationship. That's the story. Shiva and Parvati. They're a pair, they're a couple, they're a partner, they're in a relationship. Krishna and Rama. And it is said of Krishna and Rama that Krishna, the playful guy, profound and insight with many friends, many women friends around him. And in the old texts it says of Krishna, his eye opened and Radha was there with her husband, and there was a connection of the eyes of Krishna with the eyes of Radha, a romantic, sensual connection. And it is said in the text that out of this extraordinary momentary connection with the eyes, a whole tradition of spirituality and religion arose. You won't find that in the Orthodox very easily. Not very easily. And this exploration, in which sometimes it is said, particularly with this tradition and with others, somehow we have, if we go really deep, we will transcend sex. We'll go beyond it. We'll leave it behind. It's a misunderstanding of the human experience. And it's quite often said in the tradition in a whole variety of ways. And one of the teachers, I'll get to the happiness, don't go away. One of the teachers commented in California once, he said, Buddha teaches the end of desire, in all its phases and so forth. He said, you cannot make love without desire. And my response to that was, you cannot make love with desire. You can have sex with desire. You can manipulate the other with desire. You can put pressure on the partner with desire. But making love is of a different order of energy altogether from wanting and expecting. It's a different order of feeling and communication with the action that goes with it. And it's part of our responsibility and duty, in a way, here, to really to get to know the difference for those who are in relationship right now between the wanting and that warmth, energy, romantic connection and communication in which there is no demand. Same way with regard to being on the retreats here. There is so much eros goes on in the air, in a whole variety there. Has to be women and men together with interests and sexual energies towards the same gender, towards the other gender. And just on that for a moment, Dharma is not at all interested nor concerned with sexual preferences. Not in these teachings. Might be in religious teachings, but not in these teachings. No interest in that at all. There's only one primary interest is what, where is the suffering, what contributes to the suffering. That is the concern, not the preferences. And sometimes in the relationship to that here on the retreat, it so regularly happens. Regularly means daily, regularly means every retreat I've been on in the last 45 years, etc. That how easy a curiosity or an interest arises in the other, whoever she or he may be. And sometimes the curiosity and interest may be in four or five others, kind of respect for diversity, I suppose. But one may not realize in the interesting, curious thought which is arising about her or him, or more than one, one easily forgets, this is the self, forgets that others may have exactly the same interest in exactly the same person. And sometimes people will come on the one-to-one and say, Chris, I've got this incredibly romantic, erotic, sensual thing going on about somebody else on the retreat. I can't get her or him out of my mind, etc. So then I will ask, who? I'm curious who this woman or this man is interested in. Which one of them out there is stimulating such energy? I want to know. And the person says, oh, Christopher, no, it doesn't matter. They always say, it doesn't matter. And then comes the body blow from me. And I say, oh, you're not willing to be open, are you? I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, but I do say it. And sometimes. And occasionally, there's been several, you know, it's the bees around the flower. And so if the two pairs of shoes are together, it's cosmic. And coming into the hall. And the same line for the food, it's another divine providence. That one is next to the other, or whatever. And sometimes there's a force of gravity, magnetism, of the sensuality towards that particular person to sit opposite them or close to them. So if you look in the dining hall, where there's more Dharma interest than going on in here, that sometimes you might see 8 or 10 people in a circle, all close. There's space everywhere. But one of them is the focus of interest. These things go on there. So we connect with ourselves, we explore, we see what the communication is. We feel the life, and we say, as a human being, there are many ways to be romantic. The presence of the romantic does not require the presence of the other. There are many ways to live a genuinely deep, sensual, romantic life, which does not require nor depend upon the other. Because sensual through the senses, the happinesses that it can bring. Sometimes the way of life there. Always occurred to me regularly, if I may say, when I was on the road and hitchhiking across from Britain to the Far East and further and so forth, there, what a free way of life it was, and how romantic, and just to just be on the road and receive the extraordinary hospitality of Arab brothers and sisters, the Muslim community in the various countries, and that is still incredibly strong. And it was at my intention at that time to come to Israel there, but this was in June 1967, didn't seem quite the best month to come. So I bypassed continued on. And only last year in India, there's a guy from Holland on his bike in the middle of India near Bodh Gaya. And I said to him, gosh, got a bike, where did you cycle from? And he said, from Amsterdam. I said, all the way? He said, yes. Through Europe, through Turkey, through Iran. He said, I didn't want to go through Afghanistan, not surprising. Cycled right down to the deep south of Iran, crossed over into Pakistan, and from Pakistan kept cycled all the way to into India. I said, but you're Dutch, you're from Holland. Your country is in NATO. Your country has been involved in the bombing, been involved in the war on the Arab nations. I said, how were you received? And he said, in Turkey, Iran, Pakistan, and into India with its Muslim communities, he said, I don't remember paying for a meal or paying for a night in a hostel. Hospitality is still there, still present. People know the difference between governments and armies. And so sometimes in these ways of life, of moving into the unknowns and much, much more, much of that, there's a certain romance about it. The poets and the playwrights and the authors and the dancers and the arts, they communicate something of the human spirit. And we have to keep that alive, because that sensuality. Because either religion has been the problem, but to me even a bigger problem of sexuality is secular society. That really, to me, is really the big problem. I have a real doubt about so-called sexual freedom there, when the biggest industry on the net is pornography. when there's so much unhappiness in relationships and sometimes boredom in the field of in relationships of sexuality, and some spark and life. And I hear, both here in Israel and here from other countries as well, where there's a lot of conversations going on about open relationships, about engaging in different kind of sexual weekends and trainings and practices, tantric and much, much, much more. Remember, not my concern about monogamy or otherwise. That's not my interest. My interest is there any suffering? And when one person on a retreat, very recent retreat, said to me, my wife and I have been married for a decade or two there, and currently he said our sex life has really gone quiet. And we've been discussing this, and we've come to some understanding and agreement that after all these years, we're going to open up our marriage there, and we're going to be open to having or finding new partners. And he asked me what my view was. I said, you're adults, you make your decisions. But I said, what I can tell you is this, it's very high risk. And high risk may be, though you may come to a nice, mental, satisfactory agreement, it seems absolutely fine for both of you. You make your decisions with this. But it can happen, and I've heard it many times, that though the agreement's been made, an outcome of sexual freedom is such that one partner or the other says, I can't handle it. And I said to the guy, because it was a guy who was speaking to me, I appreciate the agreement, I appreciate the fact that the two of you are talking together about this, but I said, it's high risk. I said, are you prepared, if you take the step, are you prepared to lose your wife, that you don't have to lose her, you don't even have her? Are you prepared that she walks out on you? She said, I can't handle it, and she leaves. And he says, I couldn't cope with it. I don't want to lose her. Then you have to have if that's the case, you put your hand on your heart, you do not want to lose your partner, then it's going to require some deep thinking and exploration. What is it that's going to revitalize? Because boredom, loss of interest, disconnect, loss of making love, and much, much more. That needs some exploration. And some do take the risk, do explore in a fresh way. And for some, it works out okay, the open relationship. But I have to say, in listening to hundreds of people, it's a small percent. It's a risk. It's a risk. Happiness. Slowly, slowly. So we look at desire and wanting and how easily the pleasure field, the consequences, personally, socially and globally. We look at relationships there. We appreciate the romance of life and the beauties and the wonders and the beauty of the woman, the beauty of the man, the beauty of the friendship, the beauty of the feelings without the demand and expectations. We look at relationships and sensuality and sexuality and acknowledge that. And sometimes with all those wonderful energies there, we don't need to be in a relationship. Life has enough energy and vitality as well there. And the romance of life can express itself. And really looking carefully and deeply as women and men on the earth there. I mean, I might have told this some years ago. When I was a monk, it's rather sweet, there, around six or seven of us monks, young guys, all ordained, sitting in a circle in the monastery there with one of the old monks. So we were in our, we were young guys, we were doing our practice, we were in our mid-20s. And the monk we were talking to, I had the translator beside me, was 93 years of age. He looked like an army general, you know, shaved head, tough, straight back, firm. So we said to him, Longpo, that means elder brother. Longpo, you're old, really old, 93, really old. No point in thinking about the future, because you probably haven't got one. There's a certain straightforwardness in monasteries, there's no, you know, politeness, etc. And there's no point in talking about the past, because it's gone, it's all over, 93, it's all finished. When your mind wanders, what does it wander to? He said, sex. And we young guys in our mid-20s looked at him, and there was a spontaneous moment, those of you who know the Buddhist tradition, we all said sadhu, which means well said. We all put our hands together. 93-year-old, sadhu, sadhu. So I thought just before coming in here, if by chance, when I, if I get there to the age of 93, and I'm here in Eindhoven, and I'm sitting on the lawn on the chairs, because that's what we do there, and then one of you says to me, Christopher, you're really old, you could go any time, what's the point of thinking about the future, the past is gone, what do you think about when your mind wanders? And if I say sex, I'm going to be just one happy bunny. It shows that the energy is still alive and well, and it hasn't faded away despite the aging process. Life has a vitality to it. So sometimes in life, in our relationship to life, it's extraordinary how the experience of happiness can emerge in a whole variety of different ways. Out of the small things of life, happiness can come. And this happiness is healthy, it brings harmony and joy, it brings body, heart and mind together. And sometimes, even with talking with you this time, happiness comes through one of the most appreciative forms is the form of laughter. And when we laugh, there is the happiness, and the happiness moves itself through the body. And even if we've been really bored with the afternoon talk, and our mind has been wandering, and then a few people laugh about something which is said, my mind was wandering, I must have missed the joke. And sometimes the energy just flows easily and freely. The longest period of happiness, of laughter, that ever took place on a retreat started with one guy at 2:30 in the afternoon, and he laughed non-stop till 9:30 in the evening. He missed the meal, he missed the evening talk, missed the inquiry, he missed it all, he just kept laughing. And each time I went over and said to him, everything fine? Okay. And then he went on again. And there's no knowing in the human being how much laughter there is in this. It's an extraordinary phenomenon. It just can roll, and it's felt through the sensations in the body. And here, as with the lovely instructions from Carlos this morning there, we can, from past and present and future, we can feel sometimes, the happiness of the being. And it's not, and I appreciate some of you may have this concern, the last thing that we are interested in here is the feel-good factor. Whoa, step on my toes if person thinks meditation is about that. It's just that in the when we're calming the being down there, there is more receptivity. And with the more receptivity, there's more receptivity to the sweetnesses that's stronger in the happiness form and in the joy form. And the reason for this is not the feel-good factor. It is not in any way whatsoever making it an end in itself. That's not what the teachings are about. It's a liberation teaching. And what we can notice here, in the going to the deep, which is where the jewels are, in the going to the deep, as the Buddha commented, from experiencing the body to, in that first section, to calming the body, it is a freedom from just experiencing the body. From the happiness, the lovely memories, exchanges, the good humour, and much, much more, as that gets more subtle, it comes into a joy. That joy is a freedom from the happiness. It's gone deeper. That joy, going deeper into things, brings a depth, which is, in that time, going deeper, so it's a freedom from. And there are many, which we'll touch upon as the days go by, different depths of this freedom showing itself. And therefore, we can't say, oh, getting to a happiness, that's kind of the end, or getting to a joy, that's the end. These are just valuable steps in a deep discovery. And the reason for it is not even the deep experience, the feeling deep experience there, but there is a receptivity in the clarity to something from the deep, which is the kind of insights which come. If you're of a religious language person, the voice of God. That the being in the calm and the receptivity, happiness, joy, deep inner peace, is actually receptive to something which is deeper than that. And that can move into our life, move into consciousness, and sometimes it really wakes up the life. And it only takes one or two words, and the whole life can be transformed. That's what we're interested in. There's the potential for a waking up. There is a, metaphorically, a pathway. We are on the third day of this retreat together. It's a pathway towards the deep. And we are also recognizing and acknowledging that when, with the happinesses and the joys there, that also it can be without reflection. So sometimes, as was mentioned to you, we might reflect on a situation, you know, a contact, a beautiful communication. You know, sometimes you and I meet someone we haven't seen for years and years, really happy to see this person. You know, one of the old monk friends who I hadn't seen for well over 20, maybe 25 years, and kind of connected and bumped into each other. And the first thing, monks are monks, he turned to a friend and he said, gosh, I haven't seen Christopher. Must be 20 or 25 years. My God, he's proof of the aging process. Oh, thank you very much. Sadhu. Whatever. So sometimes we have a meeting, but in the unexpected meeting, as a friend of mine said, just on that moving human zoo, which is called the London Underground, there, people lost in their mobile phones, and they're reading the evening newspaper, and suddenly spotted his first lover. And she spotted him in the sea of faces in this crowded evening rush hour there. And they looked across to each other. And he said, what was extraordinary, 15, 20 years had gone by, he's in his early 30s, hadn't seen her since she was 15 or 16, there. He said, the sensation of happiness out of his body, he couldn't believe it, you know, tired and bored, and etc. And boom, in one moment, the spark, something is energized and there's happiness. And she for him. But he said to me, I asked him, oh, it's lovely. He said, yes. He said, but it ended a bit disappointing, really, Christopher. Married with two kids. It's a hard life, isn't it, really? Anyway. So sometimes the happiness comes in the moment. But there is the happiness, which is precious and important, which is just out of the being, in which happiness and the quiet joy doesn't have a reason for it. One is just happy. And those moments and periods of just happiness are jewels in the life of humanity, just to be happy without a reason. And that may be any moment of any time of any day. And we'll just allow ourselves to rest in the moment, to know those moments there. And if we can know those moments, there is more opportunity for us as human beings on this earth, not only to rediscover those moments, but the important thing is one can put hand on one's heart and say, I know experiences which are not about worry, fear, guilt, anxiety, and blame. I really know a different kind of experience. And the strength of that different kind of experience of happiness, joy, that gives extra authority to deal with the difficult. We need to know the non-difficult. And the non-difficult is arising regularly. And our practice is to be mindful of it, to be clear about it, and to recognize it. I was sitting under the tree yesterday and today, over there, in the one-to-ones. And thank you very much for the lovely sharings and communication. Right behind me, there is the pipe. And the pipe has a small leak in it, you can see. Just behind the tree there, there's the pipe with a leak in it. And there's water, and it's just filled up. Yesterday, the cat came. So having the mice one-to-one, the cat is thirsty. And we just saw, and a good person runs in, have a look, Christopher. And they just look behind, over the shoulder, and there's the cat just quietly drinking the milk. The water there, just there. And today, cat's gone, and the bird came. The bird flies down, hey Christopher, have a look. And then the bird is just sipping the water. And did you mention the conversation I had with the farmer? So, a dear friend of mine, an organic farmer, he and I were talking. And I'd just like to end the point that he talked on. It sums up the whole talk. The point we came to was, the birds, they fly through the air, the small birds, and there is danger for them because there are large birds in the sky hunting for the small birds. Small birds are on the ground, and the small birds which are on the ground are also hunted by the cats. But it doesn't stop the birds from singing. Don't forget. Thank you for listening. Thank you. Let's have our quiet minute, shall we? beings know the deep happinesses and joys of life. May all beings explore an endless engagement with the field of existence. May all beings be receptive to what is deep.